July of 2016, I had the honor of interviewing Will Allen in Milwaukee. Took an hour out of his busy schedule to spend with me. We've got quite a bit of collateral material that you can look at that tells you a lot about Will, his background, basketball player, corporate marketing, and so on. But what makes this guy truly remarkable is what he's accomplished in terms of urban agriculture. The most amazing stuff you can find in North America, maybe even in the world. Closed loop, vertically integrated, from growing his own compost all the way up to retail store, teaching thousands of people how to grow stuff, grow fish, grow animals. Just a great guy. I think this interview will put a smile on your face, a song in your heart, a little dance in your step, perhaps. He provides some great vision and some great manifestation of what's possible through hard work, through cleverness, creativity, from being the best that humans can be.
I've had a long career in growing up on a farm and, you know, establishing urban agriculture here in Milwaukee and getting it to a scale that people would pay attention to, you know, so.
Big time.
Yeah.
So I want to get a sense of what that is, because not only have you had tremendous energy and intelligence and commitment to get the thing going, you've turned this thing into a real deal business. So I'd just like to get a sense of, okay, so what farms do you have? What do you do? Yeah. How much stuff you produce?
Yeah, well, our main farm, which is the original farm, that was established in 1993 on 55th and Silver Spring. It's really the energy that led us to where we are today in terms of being able to scale it up. So along this 24-year continuum, constantly added more pieces to what I call the food system puzzle that we have, and really in trying to develop our own food system that could be replicated in other cities, not just in Wisconsin or, say, Illinois, but all over the world. But that wasn't the original idea. The original thing when I bought this farm was to sell my farm produce from my farm into a food desert area that we're located up on 55th and Silver Spring, where we have the largest public housing project called West Lawn in Milwaukee. We have dense population. 4 miles away is the closest grocery store. So it was an opportunity for me to sell some of my farm produce into that area, really looking at the community because it's mostly African-American dominated community. And the things back then, when you think 24 years ago, nobody's really talking about urban agriculture or small-scale farming. It was, you know, we were escalating large commercial farms and so forth across the country. And 99% of the food that was coming into this marketplace was coming outside, you know, 1,500 miles. And that's pretty much still, even though a little bit more is being grown by other folks. But I don't think their mission and vision was to scale it up. But I, when I first started, once I got going, was to actually engage that local community, starting with the youth in the community, and then being able to get to their parents through the kids. And that's kind of what really let people know who we are and what we're doing, and getting support from the community to be able to do the things that we do. Because historically, this was the last remaining farm in the city of Milwaukee, registered farm. So we had some rights that we could actually do animals and, you know, grow food and do all kinds of stuff. But even though you have that, you can get some pushback if you don't do the community engagement piece. So we did that kind of through the kids. Because as soon as kids see you doing something, they all run and want to get involved. And either you can push them away or you can invite them in. That's what we did. And that was the start of us becoming a not-for-profit organization, because I don't come from that world. but I have a lot of friends that were operating not-for-profit organizations and 501c3s, and they talked me into it. So, well, since you like doing this work, why don't you start a 501c3? So,
by bringing these kids in, were you giving them tours? Were you coaching them on how to build things, giving them jobs?
Yeah, we were coaching them, and because they were younger kids, we started out with a youth corps, and we'd give them a stipend at the end of the summer so that they could go and buy school clothes or whatever. And we started them at about 8 years old. And once they got into their teen years, as we moved along this continuum, we gave them real jobs on the farm and in our organization. So that's how it kind of rolled out. But early on, we had a retail store did very well because we did a lot of advertising and a lot of people came there for things like greens and mustard turnip, collard greens.
Not just the African-American
community. Pretty much for those kind of items. But we also started training folks. And then more and more people heard about what we were doing. And it became more multicultural as we moved along the continuum. Because that area, I think people were kind of afraid to... You know, white people were kind of afraid to come into that area, even though at one point, historically, it was entirely a white community.
It probably was an upscale area at one time.
Yeah, it was really the first part of urban sprawl from Milwaukee into this area because it was called Granville Township. And Milwaukee annexed the land and, you know, and things just, neighborhoods just started to change. You know, and that was one of the neighborhoods that changed when they built the housing project there and everything. So, but today, you know, it's an entirely different kind of a neighborhood in that people aren't afraid to come there because we're there. You know, our organization is there, and some good things have happened with the housing project. It's now, I believe, the only LEED-certified housing project in the country. Called Westlawn, they've reconstructed the whole thing, so it looks more like condos and apartments than it does the typical public housing project that you'll see in other areas of the country.
You were probably responsible for that change, I bet.
Well, partially responsible because the Housing Authority has embraced us, and we have a partnership with the Housing Authority for that housing project. And but one of the things I realized right away is that we had to kind of do commercial type projects for people to take us serious, you know. So we didn't do like the typical small gardening or community garden type project. We were doing farming. So being able to crank out a lot of crops and also adding more farms along the way. So we started building hoop houses and constructing our own hoop houses. I think today we're probably the largest hoop house growing system in the state of Wisconsin because we have over 100 and something greenhouses and hoop houses in this area and in Chicago and so forth. We grow year-round.
And you have a technique that really doesn't need much supplemental heat.
No. What we do... I developed this technique of using, because we have a lot of brewery waste from Lakefront Brewery and the Milwaukee Brew House and a couple other breweries. We take the brewery waste, which is a really wonderful product that we use in our compost, and we also use wood chip. And when you combine wood chip, brewery waste is on the nitrogen side. Of course, the wood chip is on the carbon side. And mix those, create a tremendous amount of heat. So what we do is we bank that material around the exterior walls of our hoop houses and the four corners. We don't plant all the way to the end. We leave space, about 10 feet of space on each end. And in the four corners, we put these big piles that may be 6 feet tall by 10 feet in diameter. We have to cap it with wood chip because you have to filter out the ammonia. because when you put carbon and nitrogen together, when you compost, you're creating ammonia. Ammonia is bad for us, and it's bad for the plants, too, to actually turn the plants white. So we found that if we put 2 feet of wood chip on the tiles, that would filter out the ammonia. So that's been working for many years.
Have you ever tried putting layers of char?
We have, you know, because what we do is in each hoop house, we have four beds that are 36 wide, 24 high, 18-inch pathways between.
So they're raised beds?
Yeah. They're really raised, you know. When you think of 24 inches, because many of these spaces are on top of asphalt and concrete. So we first put down about 8-10 inches of wood chip, and then we build the beds on top of the wood chip. And that adds a lot of heat, just the wood chip alone, before you actually, you know, build the piles in the four corners.
Now, those raised beds with kelp within containers of any kind, they're just built right?
No, they're built because we don't sift our compost. It comes right out of the system. It still is chippy and lumpy and so forth, and it holds together. So you don't have to use wood frames.
So is it held together by mycelium and other things?
Well, just the material itself. You know, eventually it'll break down to soil after so many years, but we're always adding new material because it shrinks. So, for example, if it's 24 high the first year, it'll probably lose about 8 inches. So we add 8 inches during the year at some point in time, depending on the crops that we're growing.
But so you've got a large layer of compost that you're growing in.
We grow directly into compost.
Ah, that's very unusual.
Yeah, we grow directly into our compost. Wow. And we get tremendous results.
And you get all the structure you need for the root systems?
You can grow trees in that stuff. You can grow corn. You can grow anything. You're talking 24 inches. You know, we grow tomatoes and stake them, you know, on top of asphalt. We grow cucumbers, and we trellis everything, you know, cucumbers and tomatoes and so forth.
Because most people will tell you that if you plant right into compost, that it's like getting the plant, especially the small plants, way too much nutrition too fast, and they start stringing up. So you've come up with a mix that works.
Not true, yeah. If you use one part carbon, one part nitrogen in your recipe, that is what you have to do.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and that's what we do. You have to. Most people are nitrogen deficient when they make compost because they always struggle to get nitrogen. Now, nitrogen's everywhere because in a city like Milwaukee, you know, there's so many places that you can collect food waste from and brewery waste. So, but it's that way everywhere. Every city I visit, from Atlanta to New York to California,
there's plenty of biological waste streams.
Yes. Yes. And if you're out in a rural area, of course, you're going to use animal waste for your nitrogen input. But when you're in a city or even the suburban areas where there's so many sources, from coffee grinds, from coffee roasters to, you know, cafeterias, we have cafeterias here that feed 4,000 employees a day. So there's a lot of waste, you know. Carbon is easy to come by. We're in a state where we have 68% forest. Trees are always coming down. Landscapers are chipping every day. Once they find out that you want to be a place that they can drop off their wood chip, you get more than you could possibly ever use. And then you have Ashplump, one of the largest companies in the country that trim around all the power lines. They're in every state. You know, when they're in your area, they just create tremendous amount, and all the municipalities chip, all the suburban municipalities around Milwaukee. So there's tremendous amount of carbon waste, and you know, then you got your cardboard newspaper. Carbon's not an issue; it's the nitrogen that people have to get. But to get those, you know, your competition, of course, is waste management,
rendering companies.
Yeah. So basically, what you have to do is build relationships with those companies. And I find today that most corporate companies are very friendly. They have sustainable departments. They're into sustainability. So it's an easy thing to do. It may have been a little harder 24 years ago, but today it's easy to get.
They're looking for the PR opportunities.
Yeah,
for sure.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. So we started building systems. We got into aquaponics, starting with a small system, and then I decided to use the same kind of concept to move water, and started building these large in-ground custom-built systems that can grow 10,000 fish and so forth.
Did you get into aquaponics to have an alternative protein source, or as to create a closed loop, kind of more of a closed loop system?
Well, for a protein source, but I wanted to come up with a system that didn't cost what these commercial systems cost, these mechanical systems that most of the aquaculture was, you know, in raising salmon and even lake perch. There was one organization over in Indiana, Bell Aquaculture, that's now out of business, that they had put in a $90 million investment to grow lake perch, and, you know, it failed for a lot of different reasons. But,
So I've seen you holding those lake perch and saying this is the future of food in a lot of urban areas.
Well, you can put systems in this room. You could put systems in garages and basements and families. You can put them in old buildings that were built to hold a lot of weight. You can build hoop houses. You can put them in pole barns. You can dig down holes in the ground and build, frame up the systems and use pond liner. Because the basic concept is for you to lift the water out of the tanks and have it gravity feed through rock, pea gravel or river rock, and grow plants, and the plants remediate the waste because the system goes through a nitrification process, and you have to get out basically the nitrites that the plants need to grow. So it's a kind of a symbiotic relationship between the fish and the plants to make it work.
What kind of plants do you find are particularly effective?
Watercress. So basically what we do, depending on your headspace, you can have multiple levels of growing. On the bottom level, we primarily use watercress, which is the best filtered plant that I found. And you can sell watercress for about...
And you can also eat.
Yeah, and it's just been rated the most nutritious green that you can eat. It's even more nutritious than kale and collards and things like that. So we grow a lot of watercress. We put it in our salad mix. Restaurants use it as a garnish, or they put it on, on top of a steak. It's very tasty. So we sell a lot of watercress. And it's easy to grow. People always ask me, how do I start the watercress? I reach in and grab my handful and say, here, there's your start. It just grows so easy, So so we do a lot of watercress. We do nasturtium, which is another water plant. You have to figure out what plants like to have their feet wet. For example, tomatoes. They do very well in water. Believe it or not.
But it's still soil-based.
We put it inside pots. And we put the pots in the water, and you get this wicking through the drain holes in the bottom of, say, a 12-inch pot. It's maybe the height is about 12 inches. And
You move from a higher concentration to a lower.
Yeah, and the reason I like to grow in the soil, a lot of people are growing directly in the water. You don't get that all the micronutrients you get when you grow in soil, especially in compost. So what we do is we put pea gravel, or we put coir that is fibrous coir, so that you don't get any leaching of the soil into the fish system, because that would change the water chemistry. And then we fill it with the same compost that we use to build beds. And then we top it with about an inch of worm castings, and then we plant, and then we cover the seed with worm castings. So you have all this fertility in that pot. That's how we grow. So we do about 25,000 pots of different crops at Growing Power in our different farms. Like in the summertime, what I do is I get these pots and fill them with compost. And where the hot mix was in the Four Corners, we remove that, put that in the compost system, and now we use that area for potted plants. Like I'll plant things like basil in them or almost anything, solid mix.
Do you have a separate operation to grow the seedlings, or you put the seed right into these compost
plants? We do both. I do all the seeding for broadcast seeding. There's a special, it's a whole art to broadcast seed.
Do you do it personally?
Yeah, I do it personally. Yeah.
You seed all of your houses?
I seed all of the houses. I don't do the microgreens. We grow like 4,000 trays a week in microgreens. I don't do those, but because that's pretty simple. That's the easiest thing I could teach you how to do, how to grow microgreens like sunflower sprouts, pea shoots, spicy sprouts like radishes and
yellow.
Those things, you know, we grow a lot of that stuff, you know, for restaurants that go to Cisco, that go to Malio Produce, and Roundy's is another one of our accounts, wholesale accounts. We have several in Chicago. But those folks won't talk to you unless you're able to repeat the performance 365 days a year.
You're as good as your last performance.
Yeah,
too.
You know what it's like. You're in the business. If you're going to deal with a farmer and he gives you a shot of really nice stuff and you call him up and next week and say, yeah, I really like this stuff. Can you send me, you know, 20 more cases of this? And he said, well, you know, end of relationship. You know how that goes. So it's important that you actually, if you can only do four items 365, then you do four items. Don't try to do 20 different things. And a lot of these young farmers and other people try to do a lot of things that they can't repeat the performance, because that's where it's at, you know, with buyers, you know.
So how many different crops do you grow at this point?
We grow about 150 different crops, you know, but we don't wholesale 150 different crops. But we grew it because we do, our marketing scheme is to, we go to farmers markets, we have a CSA type program, we have farm stands that we set up, we deliver to the wholesalers, we deliver directly to our own restaurants, because when we send stuff to Cisco, it'll wind up in multiple places. So it saves us a lot of money from driving, having a fleet of trucks to deliver all over the city or all over Chicago or whatever. You know. So it's important for us to work with other folks to distribute our product with our label on it and everything.
It's a branded offering.
Yeah.
How many pounds of produce do you think you produce a year?
Oh, gosh. That's something we still have to quantify. It's a lot. Because some things...
It's into the mains?
Yeah, easily, yeah. Because, you know, when you do things like winter squash that weigh a lot, you know, things like potatoes. We're growing a lot of potatoes this year.
Are you packing in traditional size boxes?
Yeah, we follow the protocol of the industry. So, for example, salad mix comes in three-pound bags. So that's what we do. You know, greens come 24 bunches to a case.
So you have a packing operation, too?
Yeah, right here.
In this building.
So that's, you know, I've been doing this a long time. I was doing this before I started growing power. I was wholesaling from my farm. So I had the knowledge to be able to pass on to folks and how to pack out, what boxes that are necessary. Like, we grow a lot of romaine in the hoop houses. I mean, romaine... Stuff that we grow rivals anything that comes out of California. So, but it's real tricky because it's heat. You know, once those houses get really hot, the stuff just bolts. So you got to be on top of it.
So that's the other thing I was going to ask you. Do you ever have overages that's difficult for you to get rid of? And how do you do that? Do you call up a couple of people and say, I need help? Do you just put an extra special price on them in your own?
Yeah, we don't do a lot of that. Extra special pricing. We'll donate stuff, you know, because that's part of who we are, to help organizations that, you know, if we have waste, we'll do that, you know. extra product in the cooler. But we try to, one of the principles that we have, we're not like other wholesalers that will give, like Second Harvest Feeding America, stuff that's got one day left on it. And if you don't sell it in a carousel that day, it's in the 30-yard dumpster. You know.
They pass a law, which are, I mean, when you donate food to organizations, you don't have any liability if anybody gets sick. So that tells you how old some of the damn stuff is and how compromised it is.
Yeah, so my thing is these emergency food programs, we try to work with them and try to influence them to buy, because a lot of them have buying power. Instead, they'll buy a semi-load of some cheap brand of vegetables, canned vegetables, rather than taking that same money and working out a deal with the farmer who, I know farmers that grow 7,000 acres of vegetables, you know. It's mostly mechanized, and when it comes in, there's so much, it was so much waste. Because when they get to those lines and they start throwing stuff off the line, you know, you get these piles of perfectly, it might be beans that end is broken off or whatever, you know. Or corn, same thing. You know, when they're packing corn, a lot of corn winds up just spread in the field or whatever instead of going out that next day to an organization that can put it into their bags and boxes or whatever. You know. So we try to encourage that kind of
thing. How many separate farms do you have?
Counting Chicago, where we have 8, probably somewhere in the range of 20, 25.
All under your brand, all under your IP, all under your technology.
Yeah.
And then do you have other farms that you buy from that are using your IP to do stuff?
We're trying to set up. One of the hardest things is to get some of these smaller growers to scale up to be able to have enough product. Because most of the production in most cities around the country, and I've been in every city, is really small scale, you know. And that wasn't our purpose to become big, but I figured for us to really develop a system that could be replicated to entrepreneurs, because a lot of what we do is training programs. We run training programs from February through June. We teach people how to do aquaponics, working with the School of Freshwater Science at UW-Milwaukee, who are the real experts in aquaponics. We've been partnering with them for about 7 years. We have a commercial urban ag training program. So let's say you've been interested in farming, you've done a little bit, you've gone to a couple of farms and worked as an intern or whatever, and you want to start your own operation, then we help them with a project plan and a business plan, and we also help them with their skill level in terms of how to grow. If they want to just do one thing, let's say you decide, well, you know, I want to grow soil for the industry. I want to set up a composting operation. So that's what those folks will concentrate on for 5 months. And then they get a certificate. They come 3 days a week every month for 5 months. And then they have a graduation, get a certificate. But a lot of them have already started their business in between the sessions, the 5 months.
So size becomes a critical factor because it gives you that economic viability.
Yeah. I mean, there's a certain level where, you can have another job and you're just doing this on this side. Or there are people that throw everything into it. And there's a lot of people that have retired early that have always wanted to farm. So they come and get the knowledge of how to do it sustainably without chemicals and everything. And they go through the program. So we've had tremendous success in helping to create businesses with folks from all over the country and all over the world.
But you haven't messed with certified organic, have you?
No.
You don't need to.
No. But I mean, we could get everything certified, but, you know. We're GAP certified. We get that, our operation. But, and we teach people how to go through GAP certification. You know, because most wholesalers, if you're not GAP certified, they won't buy from you.
Tell me a little bit about growing soil, because you realize that that's a core competency that you really need to have.
Right.
You figured out some great ways to do it.
Well, one of the things that I think a lot of people understand that our soil, 90% of our soil that food's grown in, is depleted of minerals, and, you know, we're just not producing good food for people to eat, regardless of what they pay for it, regardless of whether they say it's organic or not. That's just a label. But it all starts with the soil, and you have to make sure you have the proper minerals in your soil to produce good food. I mean, we've known that for many years, that we've depleted our soil.
And it's not just minerals. We basically created a substrate that uses a pharmacological model. You know, you keep adding chemicals to keep it going. But you need a living, vital organism.
You need microorganisms in that soil and worms. So that's the other thing we do. We put worms in our growing beds. We sprinkle worms in, and then they grow, because a lot of soil scientists will tell you need 25 worms in every square foot of soil. If we had that, then you'd have good soil. Because the worms make those minerals and those microorganisms more available to the plants. They break it down into their castings, and a worm can produce its weight in castings every day. So if you have 1,000 pounds of worms, they'll eat 1,000 pounds of food.
And those castings are basically the excretion?
Yeah, the excrement from the worms. And what happens is a worm can take in, say, 250 million count of bacteria, and they, as that passes through their body, they multiply that by 14 times. That's how important they are. And a lot of people don't understand. You know, they just say, worms in my soil, that's good. You know, but they don't understand the science behind what worms really do for us. You know, so,
in addition to aeration and keeping...
Yes,
keeping things flowing.
So we spend a lot of time, I tell people, don't farm this year. You know, let's get your soil right and get your soil tested, because now you can get sophisticated testing of soil through universities and so forth, or private companies, you know, and you can get a picture of what your soil, whether your soil has lead or whatever in it, and get all kinds of different tests. There's probably 20 different tests you can get. What is your, it's not NPK that's so important as it is knowing whether you have these trace minerals that
or
you need.
Or too much of something.
Yeah. So, you know. But once you get good at composting, it becomes pretty routine, you know, in terms of... And the plants, when you look at the plants, you can tell.
So how many tons of compost do you think?
Well, we... last year we did 40 million pounds of inputs into our growing our soil. You know.
And how much compost came out of it?
We probably did 10,000 yards. You know, because we're always collecting carbon, because that's the stable piece. That's the piece that's going to get you your bulkness. Whereas food waste is mostly water. Like a tomato is probably less than 2%. All you get is skin. You put a pile of tomatoes and let it melt down, and all you get is a little skin on the ground.
Seeds.
But those juices are so important, because they get impregnated into the wood chip and the other carbon and so forth. You also get some bulkness out of the grains, like brewery waste is more bulk than other forms of nitrogen. Coffee grinds are already 4% nitrogen. Brewery waste is 18% nitrogen. We had that tested. So that's a fertilizer. You can actually spread brewery waste on a field and work it into the soil, and you get tremendous response just from that alone. You know, so a lot of times we'll add brewery waste to existing compost, mix it. You know, take the bobcat and mix, and you get tremendous response from that, you know, before you spread it. Now, the stuff is so hot that it's important not to side dress with brewery waste because it'll kill your plants just from the heat that it produces. It doesn't take much. If you get a handful and you put it right next to a tomato plant, it might kill the tomato plant.
How hot are the internal temperatures of your compost?
135 to 150 degrees. You don't want to go over 150 because then you start killing off all your good guys, you know, your microorganisms and so forth. Yeah.
Have you tested the nutrition in your food versus commercially grown?
We've done some of that, and I'm trying to get work with some doctors that will actually work on some of that to really get down to how much more nutritious our food is versus what you just generally buy in the produce aisle of a grocery store. It could come from a co-op, could come from multiple farmers that get thrown in the mix or whatever, because that's, you know, how the system works. It would be good if we could identify, if you go and buy some broccoli, we could identify exactly where that broccoli came from, what farm it came from, what kind of soil was it grown in. Because that's where the rubber meets the road with me, is what kind of soil was it grown in, on what farm. Not that it came from...
A brand.
Yeah, some brand. Yeah, yeah. You know how it works. So, so I think that's important for us to know.
So if I said to you, tomorrow, I want to turn your business into a for-profit business.
Yeah.
How much would you have to increase your prices or change practices? Or?
We have a for-profit with nothing but professional workers on this side of the street. On the other side of the street of our organization is our projects and programs and training programs and that sort of thing. So when people reach a certain level, that we can bring them over to this side of the street. But I don't have any interns, volunteers over here with our commercial stuff.
So it's basically a model that you could show people of a sustainable business.
Yeah.
That's a for-profit business.
Yeah, exactly.
That's great.
Exactly. And I always tell people, because everybody wants to do this and they want to intermingle their trainees and volunteers over here with your professional workers, it doesn't work.
So
I haven't been able to do it.
I got to give you credit because, you know, there's a lot of romanticism, you'd say, about an idealism involved with this.
And yes.
You're not only somebody that has a commitment, has worked hard, but you've got a very intelligent approach about you understand the business. So you, when you go to these farms where you basically have like almost all volunteer work, it's like, you know, it's like a plantation again. It's like slave work, slavery.
Right.
They've got these people working for free.
Right.
And then they charge big prices when they go there. How is that a sustainable economic model?
It's not.
Right.
It absolutely isn't. And it's hard. It's hard for me because I do a lot of talks. And whenever I go to California or Colorado or wherever, New York, they want to drag me out to these farms. And the first thing they ask me, Will, we want to hear your opinion of our farm. And I have to say something positive about what they're doing, you know, because at that point in time, it's not the time to kind of rip them, you know, rip down what they're doing because you want more and more people getting involved in this. But the realism of how small-scale farming is going to work in this country in the future is it's going to be done not by nonprofit organizations. It's going to be done by entrepreneurs. Now, there is a role for nonprofits to play, but it is not to operate large farms and so forth. We're an exception because we had to prove a lot of things. There were a lot of naysayers that said, hey, you're going to do this, you're going to do that. You know, the other thing is that we have to reach into the community and find a lot of people that have worked on farms that are now living in our cities. You know, they may not speak the same language or they may not, but they want a farm. They don't like working in a factory. But we have to pay them a living wage. We got to pay the same wages that they can make in a factory, you know. So you can't start them at minimum wage. We can't treat them like migrant farm workers. You know, they have families and they live in the city. And, you know, you got to start them at a good wage. So our beginning salary is $12 an hour. and you know, which is a, I wouldn't consider a living wage per se for what person, but it's much different than what migrant farm workers get. And then very quickly we bring them up to about $15 an hour, and just keep, if they stick around, they can make a really living wage.
Do you have a franchise system or anything like that? So if I said I want to do a growing power thing in some other city, not really.
No, we would assist you to help you build your infrastructure. So you would have to pay a fee for service for me and my crew to come and help you build out, say, you, oh, I want to build 10 hoop houses on this piece of land I've acquired. And I've gone through your commercial urban ag training program, and now I want you all to help us. We know how to build a hoop house, but we want to get this up and going, and we want to do it the right way, and we want to learn, and we want to train the people that weren't able to come to Milwaukee or whatever, or to a regional training center somewhere in the country that we work with. So that's how we do it. So we don't go out and ask for work. We have to be invited, and I never wanted to push this thing and say, we, our method is the best method in the world, should go with us. You know, people invite us into projects. And that feels very comfortable for me.
When the student's ready, the teacher will come.
Yeah, yeah. So we get tremendous amount of requests that we couldn't, and some of them take a long time to evolve. Like, for example, in Atlanta, where the Braves play at Turner Field, that has been bought by a company. That's going to be a development project. They're going to tear down a stadium, and they want a farm as part of the development project, because a lot of the younger people, 18 to say 35, that would attract them to the development. If you've got your development project over here and you don't have this farm, and I've got one over here that has all these amenities like a farm and so forth, that they can get their fresh food right at their where they live in these condos or whatever they're going to build over there. So I've had groups come up and want us to help them. Well, the Braves are going to play one more year in the Turner Field, and then they're moving out into the suburbs, and they're going to tear that down and turn that into a development project. So we get a lot of requests like that with folks that are looking at urban agriculture and food systems on a local level.
Are you growing fruit also?
Yeah. We've got a county gave us 10 acres of land where I live in Oak Creek, which is south of Milwaukee. It's right on the border of Milwaukee, going south by the airport. We have a 10-acre orchard there. We receive trees from Stark Nursery, which you've probably heard of, out of St. Louis. They have a mail order nursery program. They provide all the trees that you'll find at the Walmarts and potted stuff, and they just have a huge business. Been in the business 200 years. It's the 200th anniversary. My son, who's a partner at a law firm, Foley and Lardner here, his firm represents one of the principal owners. And I found out that they, at the end of the season, they have these huge warehouses, cooler warehouses. They pull up, say, 50 acres of bare-rooted trees and bundle them and put them in the coolers, and they stay in this kind of suspended
hibernation
state. And then, like I said, their workers will pot up a lot of stuff that they sell semi-loads to all the marts around the country. And then at the end of May, every year, whatever's left in the warehouse, they would burn, because they don't want to replant. Where they've taken these trees, they put in the rootstock and, you know, start that field all over again, you know, until they reach a certain height. Probably takes a year or two or whatever, I don't know. So they started giving us whatever was left. So I send a truck down, we pick them up, and we pot them up or we hill them up. And I just got 3,000 trees a few weeks ago.
Wow. And is it going right into the soil, or is it going into compost, or are you taking the compost and laying it?
Well,
we
dig a hole, because most of these places have really poor soil, and put compost and plant them and water them. And then we have to, in the fall, put sleeves on them, because otherwise they'll get ringed and they're dead by squirrels and rabbits and so forth. So
Will, I see in your handout information that you're, one of the major projects that you're looking to do is a vertical agriculture project.
Right.
Now there's, you know, some of these around, even some people partner with Whole Foods, but they put them on greens and all the other
things. This is totally different.
Right, so that's what I want to hear. And I wanted to get your reaction to some of what those guys are doing.
Yeah, those things have limitations. There's only so much you can produce. They're mostly for show, really. I mean, you know.
And they're also not soil-based.
No. A lot of stuff, they're doing aeroponics and all this kind of stuff. And, you know, hydroponics, which we don't do. But what this is going to be is a building. I don't know if you got a picture of it.
Yep.
When you look at that building, it's from the ground up. That building is designed by U.S. Greenhouses, the greenhouse part of it. Because of our zoning or whatever rules, we have to pour solid floors on each one. The bottom floor will have a pretty large retail grocery store. And then on the second floor is where
it's going to be yours?
Yeah, at 55th and Silver Spring. And on the second floor will be the first greenhouse, and then the next one on the next floor, all the way up, and the top floor will be completely greenhouse. It'll be positioned so you maximize the light. Inside, you can push buttons, and inside each house, there'll be multiple levels of growing. So if you're a worker inside, you push a button, whatever you're working on, a tray or a pot, moves right in front of you. So you can either harvest it, water it, whatever you got to do.
Will you supplement with any artificial light?
We'll use renewable energy there.
We'll use LED?
Probably some light in the wintertime, because there's that period of about a month and a half, 2 months, where you have to use some supplemental lighting for some crops. But we'll have the ability in this greenhouse to grow almost any kind of crop, from tomatoes to peppers, year-round.
You said something very important, which was if you didn't have the indoor and hoop house capacity that you have right now, you'd be in a bit of trouble given the climate, the drought.
So. Oh, yeah, we're in trouble. We're in trouble this year outside because it's so dry. We just worked up a field a couple of weeks ago. We can't plant until it rains.
So how important is going to be indoor growing in the future?
It's going to be everything. It's going to mean everything because we're having so many problems with airborne viruses on tomatoes all over the country. When you look and go to California and just follow one company, you look at Driscoll. Most of their production now is raspberries and strawberries in the same kind of hoop houses that we put up. You know, I saw a 300-acre field of nothing but hoop houses. They use more water, believe it or not, growing inside. But the product is superior, less insect pressure because of a lot of the rules they have in California and using certain pesticides and so forth. So that is the future, whether it's in warm climates, cold climates, or whatever climate. It's a lot easier to do in, say, climates like if you were, say, in trying to think of a state, say, North Carolina or Georgia. It still gets cold down there, but you'd have to have less protection than we would up here.
So what do you do? What are the hoop houses made of? What is the covering?
The covering is just poly, greenhouse poly, double-layer greenhouse poly.
And that can withstand snow loads?
Yeah, yeah. If you build them the correct way, you have 5 purlins. You have a center purlin, and then you have 2 metal purlins, and then you have a 2x4 purlin 4 feet off the ground. So when you pull the plastic, it's not like the old days where plastic goes from ground to ground. you pull the plastic over, and it goes from 4 feet off the ground to 4 feet off the ground. And then the other piece goes down, and you attach it at 4 foot level, and you attach it to the bottom. You can take the bottom piece and roll it up in the summertime so you get north, south, because these have to be orientated east-west. You put 8 foot doors in so you get that east-west ventilation so you don't need fans and stuff like that. We use shade cloth in the summertime for certain crops here in Wisconsin.
Can you put that over on the outside?
Yes, that goes over the top. And, you know, depending on the weather, so you got to, you know, if you're in different areas, you have to obviously do it a little bit differently. Like we put up hoops in Haiti. Instead of plastic, we just use shade cloth because obvious reasons, it's 100 degrees every day.
And a lot of sun.
And a lot of sun, so, yeah.
So if you were doing this in Montana where you got 3 or 4 months of pretty overcast size, not too much solar energy hitting, you'd have to use some supplemental light, right?
Yeah, not all year long.
But during those
dark.
And you think that the technology you've come up with basically lining the outside of this with your compost to generate enough heat?
Certain crops that are winter hardy crops. Like if you look in the Johnny's catalog, there's a little snowflake by a lot of things. And those things would probably survive. Things like kale or collards, even things like cilantro.
But otherwise, you might have to use some supplement.
Possibly in some of those areas, but not a lot. Because if it gets down to, say, 20 below zero actual temperature and wind chills of 50 below, everything freezes. But a lot of these crops bounce back. After they've been in a frost, they'll come back. You know, a couple of days when it warms up, they'll come back. So it helps, but, I mean, when it gets down to 20 below zero,
have you ever experimented with underground growing?
I haven't. I guess the thing is, if you're going to do it on a commercial scale, you got to have a business plan and really to figure out, are you going to make money by expending all of this money to go underground and build all this stuff that costs a lot of money? You know, that's why before we build a 100-story vertical farm, we need to build a 5-story and study that. And so that's what we're doing. Is to this 5-story building, and that's what the guy from Columbia University that did these schematics of 100-story buildings to feed 100,000 people in New York and Boston, you know, cities that don't have a large land mass like, say, a Detroit or Chicago or even Milwaukee. We're going to have to go up. And as we look into the future with all these billions of people that are going to be in our system in 30 to 40 years, how are we going to feed them if we don't go up? Because all of these people are moving into big cities, and new cities are going to crop up, and how are we going to feed these folks?
So, Will, could you grow fruit and have these fruit trees, you think, inside a structure?
Oh, yeah. They're doing it in a farm in Minnesota, a huge farm where they have apple trees, dwarf apple trees, and all different kinds of trees inside.
So fruit, vegetables, fish. I also saw somewhere where you've got animals.
Yeah, we have goats and chickens in the city. You know, and of course, you know, the fish. So we're going to have to, I think the fish are going to be one of the most important things because China is the largest producer in the world. Then we have the other countries, and the U.S. has a small sliver, about 1% of fish production we have today.
And within a relatively small space, you can grow a heck of a lot of fish.
A lot of fish, yeah. And you can almost grow any variety. I mean, when you look at what China's been able to do, they've taken over our catfish. If you go out and buy catfish, chances are it's coming from China. Tilapia, China. Grown in some of the worst water that you would
Absolutely.
Ever think about.
I won't eat from raised fish unless it's from very, very special places.
Yeah, because what they do is they raise it. It's a cichlid, takes in food as it breathes. The water chemistry doesn't have to be that great. you know, for them to survive. And then they grow very fast. In 6 months, you got a fish that's a 3-pound tilapia. They take them out. They put them in fresh water. They call it purging, which passes the U.S.
FDA and USDA.
FDA, yeah. They've approved this method of us eating. So when you go and buy frozen tilapia fillets at $5 or sometimes $3 a pound, and that's what people, oh, I just love tilapia. I go out to dinner with people and they order tilapia. And I say, are you sure you want to order that?
How your food is grown.
Yeah, most people have no idea what they're eating.
Well, you've accomplished something totally remarkable.
Well, it's not without challenges. I mean, when you're doing training, it takes a tremendous amount of money to train people because you can't just write grants, you know, to stay in this business.
Are you charging tuition for people to come to train?
Oh, yeah. We do a lot of scholarships, but we also charge, you know, like for our aquaponics trainings, for weekend training, it's like $400. But they get to go to university and professors from the university. We spend a day with them and they tell them how to keep fish alive, you know, what the biological thing about fish. And then we bring them to Growing Power and they have to build a system. And we take them through the protocol of how to keep these fish alive in terms of in a hands-on way. And the filters, the filtering you have to do to make up water that you have to add to the systems. These are closed-loop systems, so, but you still have to, because of evaporation and water chemistry, because you're testing the water a couple of times a day to make sure the water chemistry is right for certain species that require, for example, a tilapia is easy. We cut our teeth on tilapia. That's pretty easy to raise tilapia. You almost have to deliberately try to kill them. But a lake perch, very sensitive to changes in water. For example, I was telling you about the pots. If you put up there, if you get up there with folks and they start moving pots around and mess up the water chemistry, you're going to get some fish deaths the next day. You'll have fish dying the next day. So you got to be very careful depending on the type of fish. Now, they're doing things like bass, striped bass. You can do bluegill, hybrid bluegill. You can do walleye. I mean, almost any species in these natural systems you can grow. So it's kind of interesting. Shrimp.
Have you ever experimented with some saltwater species?
Never have. Yeah. I want to do some eels. But eels are, you can't really have a brood stock of eels. You have to buy baby eels and raise them out. Because the eel has to leave fresh water, go into salt water, and then return to fresh water to breed. So that's a little tricky.
Yeah, salmon's the,
yeah.
The same situation.
Herring, salmon, and all that. I'm from the D.C. area, so every year we have a herring run. Back in the day, there would be millions of herring. They used to come out of the Chesapeake, up the Potomac, into the creeks, and breed, and then they die. So, you know, that's the time that you net them. And back then, they let you use snag hooks to snag them. Even. There's so many of them, all you have to do is go out and you got them. So we used to do couple thousand, salt them down, and eat them all winter, you know. And even eat the roe, the caviar. Yeah, they have probably the best tasting roe, you know, if you're into that sort of thing. But that's the way my family was raised, on a lot of natural stuff like that.
So, is there anything else you'd like to tell folks?
Well, there's a lot. I think one of the main things is that we have to get this next farm bill right to help support entrepreneurial small farmers. We need more money for training, for farmer training, because, you know, you can't grow a farmer in a year. So we got to, you know, a lot of good things are happening at the schools, and, you know, there's tremendous interest in folks that want to do this, but they don't necessarily understand how hard it is to become a sustainable farmer. So I think what's missing is money now. We've got so much interest in people, but they don't have the funds to do it. We want to get FSA to be able to give loans, farm loans, to small urban farmers and small-scale farmers that are farming on the edges of the cities. Right now, if you went for a farm operating loan, you probably wouldn't get one. So we're trying to get that. We're working with the Ag Secretary, who's visited Growing Power Vilsack, and he really likes what we're doing. And I'm working with his office.
If he cares, how could he not?
Yeah. So we've been working with his office to try to change some of these things to get in position to be able to get an operating loan. Even with our size of operation, we weren't. I called FSA this winter to see if we could get an operating loan. And they said, well, you're a nonprofit, you can't get it.
So, Will, let me ask this, because you have a lot of life experience. Let's say that your way of doing things became very pervasive, mm-hmm. went mainstream. There's a lot of vested interests that would be threatened by that.
Yeah, but I think at this point in time, industrial agriculture, people don't think, or they're not troubled by that right now. And they probably shouldn't be, because the production levels are still very low. So it doesn't affect, they don't see the needle moving from...
But let's say that needle did move.
Yeah.
Then would that create a special kind of headwind that would create other kinds of problems, you think?
I don't know. I know Michael Pollan. I know Michael pretty well, and we talked about when he came to Wisconsin. Wisconsin Farm Union, one of those, wrote some very nasty things about Michael when he came here, because of his popularity and so forth. He was doing a talk at UW-Madison, and the Madison papers had some articles with farmers, industrial farmers, criticizing him and stuff. I don't know how nasty it would get in the future. I think right now we need to just work on trying to engage more farmers before that. And so it doesn't become like we're going to attack Michael Pollan or Will Allen. If we're able to get our act together, get enough people doing this stuff, and if they do complain, because what's happening also is consumers have come on board. So consumers are really pushing this. And that's why all these retail grocery stores like Whole Foods and Roundy's, all these warehouses want locally grown food. It used to be like, oh, we're just going to get a few locally grown food items and sure. satisfy these folks. But these folks are coming in these grocery stores and they want, what are the local labels? So what I see is that the next step is they have sections in the produce aisles that say locally, regionally grown product. It doesn't necessarily have to be all organic. It could be natural or it could even be conventional. But 90-some percent of people would rather buy locally grown food.
It's one of the main drivers right now.
Yeah.
More so than
And that's what's driving these wholesalers to call us and say, what do you have? You know, that didn't happen 10 years ago.
What do you think about GMOs? What's your position?
Don't like them. You know, I think we don't know what Roundup does to our bodies. I've talked to scientists and they at the University of Wisconsin-Madison that know that they cause birth defects in laboratory rats. They haven't tested humans or whatever, but they can't really speak about it because they're getting funded by those guys. So there's one scientist that I talked to, professor, he said he knows for sure that Roundup is should be banned, the way he put it.
So we're not getting the straight dope, Bob?
No. I don't think so. So.
But, well, you're an exceptional human being. You're doing something exceptional for the world. Well, it's just been an absolute honor for me to meet you and have this time with you.
Well, I hope it does some good.
It will.
Because we really need to, and we talk about this all the time, it's hard for us to, as producers, if you're a producer or whatever, to toot your own horn, you know. So it has to come from folks that are going to really tell the truth about what's happening, and they have to understand what's happening. And, you know, California agriculture, for example, is on a decline because of their water situation.
And degradation of soil.
Yeah, soil and overpopulated areas.
Salt infestation.
Yeah, I know a farmer out there that his family used to own McGrath. Do you know them on 101 out of Ventura County? Phil McGrath. His family owned all, at one point, back in the 1800s. I've been on his farm. They owned all the land from the Pacific 13 miles in.
There's huge land grants made.
Okay. And then the family started, a big family, they started selling off pieces of the land. Now they're down to the family has 300 acres. He farms 25. The cost of 300 acres, they lease out to Driscoll at $3,500 an acre. He pays $3,500 an acre because the corporation is a family corporation, and he's the only farmer of the family now. So he pays that for his little farm.
That used to be the maximum yield you could get out of an acre. Never mind pay for an acre.
Yeah, I mean, I complain when we pay $200 an acre here. You know? But imagine $3,500 an acre. You got to grow year-round, and they are. And that's one of the reasons for the hoop houses. Now you can buy California straw. Remember, there was a shutdown period in California. Now you can get California berries year-round because they're growing them inside. And they develop different varieties that can grow in cooler temperatures. But in Ventura, in those places, the temperature never really changes very much.
Well, I've totally enjoyed this. I feel it's an honor to have met you. Thank you so much. Thank you.